So, chapter 13. With all this talk about all the gifts, and that's what he wants, and he wants them to care for each other in the community, and he wants them to love. So now he goes into one of the loveliest passages of Paul. He says, look, I'll show you a still more excellent way. If I speak human or angelic tongues. So here are these people thinking that the gift of tongues, I haven't got it, so I haven't got the Spirit. Or I've got it, so you don't have the Spirit. All this bickering going on, you're saying, for God's sake, if you spoke every language in the world and spoke all the languages that the angels speak, but do not have love, I'm just a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. That's good, isn't it? If I have prophetic powers, understand all the mysteries, big stuff, and all knowledge, well, they're saying how knowledgeable they are, gnosis, very important. You could know everything that is to be known, he says. I can have all faith so as to move mountains, obviously a quote from Jesus, by the way. If you had the faith to move mountains, and he doesn't mean physically move a mountain from here to there, what the heck would you be wanting to do that for, and how, and it's never been done and it doesn't happen. He means the mountain Jesus is talking about is Jerusalem and the temple. He's talking about moving the Vatican, if I could say so, like moving institutions that are locked into something. I don't mean the Vatican is, but that's the equivalent in an image we could say. If you could move this big institution of the temple, faith to move that. Okay, well, if you had faith to move mountains, but do not have love, I'm nothing. Isn't that important? I mean, do you really believe it? Do I really believe it? I think I do believe it, but do I live it? Any knowledge I have that is not aware that God is love, and that loving, and I don't mean softness, I mean wanting the spiritual good of the other, I mean respecting the other, I mean debating with another, looking for truth, not looking to put someone down, you know, all that, love. If you haven't got love, you don't know anything. You've got all this knowledge, but you don't know anything. You've just missed the absolute essential knowledge, which is that God is love. So Paul's saying it better. I shouldn't have said anything there at all. But you can do all of this, he says. But if you haven't got love, it's nothing. I can give away all my possessions. I hand over my body. And the problem here is the text. The original texts we have, some texts have one, some texts have another. So it's a problem of which is the original text. That I may boast or to be burnt. Could be either. And it all depends on one consonant in the Greek. Kauchesomai or kauthesomai. Theta or kai. So in the transcription of the text, we've only got copies, of course, even though they're right back to the end of the 3rd century, so they're early enough. But when you look at them, they're different, and we've got no way of... So he's either saying, hand over my body to people in a way that I can boast about, what I'm self-giving, that I'm good at, or hand it over to be burnt, martyrdom, whatever. But I don't have love, I gain nothing. So you can see what he's doing. He's saying to the community, for heaven's sake, go for love. If you go for love, you'll be fine. If you neglect love and go for these other gifts, you'll just divide the community. Is any proof? Then he starts to talk about what love is, and we all know this text beautifully, but I've got some really important things to say to you about it. But before I do, I want to just read for you what I've given you on that single page to get the context ready. The word love, Greek agape, hasn't featured so far in this letter. Paul mentioned it in passing in chapter 4, verse 21, And then again briefly in a text which pointed in the direction of the present passage when he said, knowledge puffs up, inflates people, but love builds up. That was in chapter 8, verse 1. The verb agapao has appeared twice, but without any development of the theme, in chapter 4 and then in chapter 8. For an introductory treatment on the significance of agape, it would be good to go back, and we did it actually together, many of us, when we were looking at Galatians. Paul listed it as the first of the fruits of the Spirit, love. Though the word hasn't featured so far in this letter, the reality has been central to everything that Paul has written. For it's not any kind of love to which Paul is referring in this passage. He's speaking of the love that is revealed in the Son of God loving me and giving himself for me. Immediately after introduction to this present letter, Paul writes, I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that all of you be in agreement, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be united in the same mind and the same purpose. That's chapter 1, verse 10. He doesn't use the word love, but it's clearly about love. He goes on to demonstrate the futility of their so-called knowledge, for they lack, he says, the mind of Christ. They lack wisdom. They lack the ability to recognize in the cross the revelation of God. Paul counters their boast of having power by declaring that the only real power is the power of the cross, which is a power of love. He goes on to reprimand them for their failure to stand up for the truth and to protect the community against the persistent immoral behavior of one of its members. Once again, he speaks of the cross. Our paschal lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed. It is the love revealed in Jesus on the cross which demands of them, as he says in chapter 5, verse 8, sincerity and truth. The Corinthians are claiming to be free to do anything they like. Paul reminds them, you were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. He makes the same point later when advising them not to concentrate on changing their state of life, but on giving their unhindered devotion to the Lord. Knowledge without love can be destructive, as he says. Knowledge puffs up, inflates, but love builds up. Anyone who loves is known by God. Criticizing them for their insensitivity in eating food offered to idols, in spite of the hurt that it's causing others in the community, Paul reminds them that it was for these others that Christ died. He presents his own practice of becoming all things to all as a model for them to follow. He draws their attention again to the cross, and in the light of the cross he appeals to them, chapter 10, verse 24, do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. The inspiration for such behavior is the example of Jesus, an example which Paul himself tries to imitate. I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, so that they may be saved. Be imitators of me, as I am of Christ. In criticizing their behavior at the community assemblies, he once more refers to the mystery of the cross. Christ expresses the meaning of the cross for him when he celebrated his Last Supper. They should do the same. Otherwise, as he said, it is not really the Lord's Supper that they are eating. It is by the test of love that their claim to have special knowledge is shown to be false. It's by the test of love that Paul condemns their approaching pagan courts to solve their community problems. He uses the same test to condemn their attitude to the blatant incest of one of their members. It's by the test of love that he assures the married and the single state, and whether that he assesses the married and single state, and whether or not they should eat meat offered to idols. Even one's way of dressing is to be judged by the same criterion. Paul has just demonstrated the Catholic nature of the church. Everyone has a different gift. All are needed that the church may live and witness to the glory of the exalted Christ. There is place for every expression of love in the community, which is the body of Christ. And without love, no gift can claim to be from the Spirit. It is this gift of love to which Paul now turns. Paul's claim is that Christ sent him, he said in chapter 1, to proclaim the gospel, not with eloquent wisdom, so that the cross of Christ might not be emptied of its power. When he was among the Corinthians, the only thing that occupied his attention, he said, was Jesus Christ and him crucified. For him to love, to which we now turn, is no exception. And we will not be able to understand or appreciate it unless we reflect upon it. As we reflect upon it, we contemplate Jesus, who showed us what true love is when he gave his life for us on the cross. So this is a hymn not to love, but it's a contemplation of the love Jesus gives, which reveals who God is. And now Paul finds some very beautiful words to talk about what love is as we see it in Jesus. The first important thing that I want to draw to your attention, and I am baffled by this, all the translations that I know use adjectives throughout this text. Love is kind, love is gentle, love is. Okay. So they're using adjectives to describe what love is. Now, you know the English language as well as I do, and you know that an adjective is a qualification of something. It can be quite abstract. Love is this. Every single word used by Paul in this section is a verb. That is so important. You've got to translate it as a verb. It's about what love does, not what love is. Do you get me? Now, they're not contradictory, but you can be something. Paul's not talking about what it is. He's talking about what it does, verb. It's active every single time. So in my humble opinion, I guess it's humble, you must translate this by verbs, and that's what I've done. So let's start. Love is patient is what you have in the New Revised Standard Version and in most versions. It's a verb Paul uses. I will translate it. Love keeps on caring. I have said this to you before. Let me say it again. There are two words for patient. One of them Paul's going to use right at the end of this passage. The usual word for patient is someone who's something's happening to me that's really hard, but I stand up and I bear it. It might be physical suffering, it might be the loss of a loved one, it might be reputation being destroyed or lied about or anything at all, eh? You go through any of your difficulties you've had to put up with. And sometimes we collapse under the pain of it all. But if we're patient, we can bear it, okay? That's not the word used here. Bearing a weight that's crushing you. No, this word is an active word. It's keeping on doing something even when it's difficult, which is quite different. Keeping on caring for a loved one, a baby that's sick even though you haven't had any sleep for 3 nights, mum, or whatever it is, or staying with a teenage son or daughter who's got caught up in a wrong group and getting into drugs or something and you're still loving them and it's really hard, but you do, or whatever, you get your own examples. The verb is makrothumeo. It's a word used often of God in the Old Testament, where it's often translated slow to anger, which I think is a very negative way of putting something that's immensely positive, but that's how it's often translated, and it's sometimes translated patient. Long-suffering is another translation for this word, which is better. God is love, and I think the best makro means long, as distinct from micro, which means short. So makrothumeo means God keeps on loving, like the father of the prodigal son, is a good example. Keeps on doing this. keeps on, whatever God keeps on doing. It's sharing in God's magnanimous love. It's a big-hearted love. In doing good and not allowing ourselves to be put off by opposition or suffering. The best example is Jesus on the cross that I know of, who kept forgiving, kept loving, kept praying, kept being who he was in that terrible situation. It's part of the Old Testament creed. This text in Exodus 34:6, the Lord is, now it's usually translated there, slow to anger, but that creedal text there occurs in every part of the Bible. It's about 7 or 8 times you'll find it. I won't give you all the references now, but all over the Bible this comes in like a creed. God is compassionate and merciful, and goes through a lovely list of things that God is, including this makrothumos, which is an adjective. Paul lists this among the gifts of the Spirit in Galatians 5:22. The fruit of the Spirit is, now it's a noun here, love, kindness, gentleness, etc. And this one, makrothumia. I don't know how to better to translate it than keeping on loving when it's really hard. So love keeps on caring, keeps on loving, keeps on this. The next one, another quality of love. Love is kind, that's fair enough, except that it's a verb here. So love keeps on behaving in a kind way, is how I would put it. It's a long sentence for one little word, but you've got to put it into a verb. And here we're told it's a word, krestos. It's often used in the Old Testament of God, Psalm 25. Romans talks about using both these words together again, because he's taking it, that's where he learns his language from the Old Testament. The riches of God's krestotes, the noun, kindness, and makrothumia, the two words we've just had here. So I hope I'm just showing you that to let you know that Paul isn't writing this out of nowhere. He's writing it from the literature of the Old Testament in its description of God. But he's seeing it as revealed in Jesus, which really clarifies it. And so he's asking us to be like Jesus in living the life of God. Be kind to one another. They're the first two qualities of love. Then Paul goes on to talk about what love doesn't do. So it does that, but it doesn't do this. So you can have a little check of your life. Hope you end up all right out of all this. The New Revised Standard Version says, love is not envious. Okay, that's okay. But doesn't behave out of, now the word zelos, zeloo, the verb, basically it means jealously. But it is used in the Greek, it's the feeling that actually captures both jealousy and envy. So I don't want to kind of say it's jealousy and not envy, or envy and not jealousy, and jealousy and envy often get mixed up in English anyhow. So it's that, whatever that feeling is, it's basically zeal. If it's jealousy, it's zeal, aggressive kind of feeling to defend what I've got. That's what jealousy is. You're jealous of what you have. You're envious of what you do not have. That's the distinction, I think. So, but it's the same feeling. I either want what you've got and I go after it, or I don't want you to have what I've got and I hold on to it. Whichever way it is. Those two pretty common feelings that corrupt the human psyche. Well, love doesn't behave like that. The Corinthians, just to put it into context, have special showy gifts like tongues, one of them, that people can see. And they're jealous of it, or they're envious of it, if they haven't got it. And they're the two problems. But love isn't about that. Love is, if I love, then I see you with a gift. I'm really happy. Some people do this easily by temperament. It's a lovely ability, and it must come from mums and dads and people around you. When someone has a gift, you know, some people are, they feel, oh, I'm not as good as that person, you know. I'm not good at this. I wish I was as good as that person. You know, that's their feeling which is digging into other little funny little envies. Other people are, wow, isn't this wonderful? Jack is just so good at this. Or Mary is fantastic. I'm an opera singer, but oh, Mary's voice is, you know, just 50 times better than mine. Isn't that a pretty good reaction to have? The joy that you have to see someone having a gift, because you're all benefiting from it. Now, what's your spontaneous feeling when you see someone with a lovely gift? If it's love, it'll be joy, delight, that that person has this gift. If it's not, it might be either putting yourself down, or, you know what I mean? Something a bit meaner, a bit smaller, a bit, or even a lot worse. Love, he says, does another thing it doesn't do, it doesn't brag. Now, he doesn't use this word here anywhere else in his letters. It's a one-off, but he's always talking about, in this letter, about people boasting, which is pretty well the same thing, criticizing those who are boasting about their gifts. Well, love doesn't. Love's not on about that. Love doesn't behave arrogantly. This is the word phusio, or phusa in Greek, is the bellows. You know, when you're kind of puffing air strongly in to fan the flame in the to heat up the stuff so that you can, you know, you've got your clay and you're firing the clay or something, you know, the bellows are going in. Well, this word is that. So a person puffing themselves up, really. Arrogance is perhaps a word for it. Doesn't behave in that way. He's already said knowledge does that. It puffs you up. It makes you arrogant if you're not careful. But love never does that. Love builds. It doesn't behave indecently. And this word in Paul, when he uses it in other places, the connotations are sexual. So there's a modesty and a tenderness and a delicacy which are proper to love in its sexual expression. It doesn't mean sexual, only genital sexual. Everything we do is sexual, I'm sure. But it means in our relationship with other people, as a man or a woman, we're tender and careful and delicate and not using this energy for power or abuse or anything like that. So love is like that. Love doesn't insist on its own way. Just a comment here. It's because the Jews sought miracles, wanting proofs of divine power that satisfied their expectations, that they found the cross a scandal. They wanted to recognize God on their terms. Jesus, public ministry, show us a sign. Do something wonderful and then we'll believe in you. Help us, he's doing something wonderful. He's actually loving people. Is there anything more wonderful? But that's not good enough. They want something that'll, you know, be big and important and hit the headlines and show everybody. Okay, it's because people were concentrating their attention on changing their state of life that they were failing to give unhindered devotion to the Lord. I'm a Jew, I'm a Gentile, I'm circumcised, I'm uncircumcised, I'm a celibate, I'm married, I'm whatever, all those different... Forget about it, says Paul. Get on to love. We're reminded of Paul's earlier admonition, which we read, do not seek your own advantage, seek that of others. So love isn't always insisting on its own way. He continues the negative in that sense, what love doesn't do. Love doesn't behave in an irritable way. Love doesn't brood over wrongs. New Revised Standard Version says love is not resentful. It's fair enough. But it means he doesn't calculate things negatively all the time, looking at what's wrong and holding wrongs against, brooding over things that have gone wrong all the time. And my comment on that is that while neither the word irritable nor the word resentful occurs elsewhere in our letter, so we can't have any other literary connection, it's not difficult to imagine the behaviour of those in whom these feelings were aroused as they saw their freedom to behave as they wished being criticised by others in the community. We can imagine the feelings of irritation and resentment with some experience of not being able to take people to court, or behave sexually as they wished, or divorce, or eat meat offered to idols, or wear any kind of hairstyle they wished, or dine well with their friends at the Lord's Supper. People with their own little agenda, being love requiring them to let it go, and they don't want to let it go. Nor is it difficult to imagine similar feelings being aroused in those who were pressured into eating meat against their conscience, or who came to the assembly only to find themselves humiliated, sitting out there while others were feasting over here. Feelings of irritation and resentment and brooding over wrongs are pretty common. So we might have those too. But love can take us beyond that. And finally, as a negative thing, another thing that love doesn't do, it doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing. It rejoices in the truth. And the truth in Paul, as in the Gospels, as in the New Testament, it means truth, but it means ultimately who God really is. So all it means that God is love. It's whatever Jesus revealed about God, that's the truth. Well, love rejoices in it. It doesn't rejoice at people being hurt or doing wrong or suffering while they've done wrong, and serves them right and all that stuff. Then he comes back to a positive statement, and I've got a very funny translation of this to offer you, but not for no reason. The New Revised Standard Version simply says, and there are only two words in Greek, love bears all things. That's quite good. It's probably better than what I've given, but I want to open it up for you. Stegos, stege is the verb. Stege, the noun, means the roof. That's the word for a roof. So the image is of the roof holding, supporting, because on top of the roof they would have their gardens, and that's where they'd sit in the open, and that's where they'd have upstairs. And the roof wasn't the final gable. It was a solid roof, or whatever it was made of. That's the stege. So it supports, it contains, it holds. It's a very big word, and it's got the idea of space and holding. And the word panta can mean all things, or it can mean all people. It's everything. So I've translated it. Love has space enough to hold and bear everything and everyone. That's hardly a translation, but I think it gets the feeling of it. Some people have a big heart. They've got space for everybody in it. And that's what we're being encouraged to have. There's space for some of you mums have too many kids probably, and you haven't got the space for them, I don't know. My mother had 8 kids, but she had space for 8 kids. And I don't think you should have 8 if you haven't got space for it, you know. So everyone's different here. But there are some people who can manage. Dad couldn't manage 8 kids, I don't think. But Mum could. So was it fair? Was it unfair? I'll leave all that into the mystery of life. But space is a beautiful thing to have in your heart, isn't it? To embrace someone else. Big-hearted. Okay. To hold and to bear everything and everyone. Paul is thinking, I think, of the heart of God, whom he's already said, from whom are all things and for whom we exist. All things come. There's enough space in the heart of God for everybody. He's thinking of the heart of Christ, again quoting his earlier passage, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Their crucified Lord has space in his heart for all the members of the Corinthian community, indeed for the whole human race, for whom he gave his life. So if we want to know what love is, we look at Jesus, he shows us God, and we learn from him to have space in our heart for the stranger and the broken and the different and the exile and the person of a different religious persuasion. Our hearts can embrace them. Love believes all things. God knows everyone and everything with the knowledge of one who loves. In other words, God continually believes in you and believes in me and believes in the young son, the father of the prodigal son, and believes in Mary of Magdala and believes in the thief on the cross, has a kind of faith in us. Wherever we've been, whatever we've done, and we're asked to have that faith in each other right to the end, leaving judgment to God. Love hopes all things. One who loves is attentive to present communion with the one loved. But the present moment isn't static or isolated. Rather, it points to and opens up a future communion for which we long and to which we're called. Our present union encourages us to leave the future confidently in the hands of Him in whom we've placed our trust. Hope is not the same as expectation. The virtue of hope in the Christian life is trusting the future to God so that we can live the present in love. That's actually what hope is. It's not anxiously wanting the future, it's knowing that the future is insured so that we can leave it in the hands of God and put all our attention on the only existence we really have, which is the present moment. Far from hope distracting me from this moment into a hope for the future, it actually focuses me on the present moment because I can afford to leave the future in the hands of God. Love, and here's the word for patience. Hupo meneo, to remain under. Is it hupo under? Remain is taken straight from the Greek, meno, to remain. So love endures all things. That's the patience, enduring. Able to remain faithful to love in the midst of the opposition. The supreme example is Jesus on the cross. And Paul concludes by saying, love never ends. So, there it is, and that's his beautiful statement about what love is, and then we can move quickly through the rest of this chapter. As for prophecies, they'll come to an end. As for tongues, they'll cease. As for knowledge, it'll come to an end. For we know only in part, we prophesy only in part, but when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. Spoke like a child? Gift of tongues. You got it? See, that's what he's coming back to. Babel. It's not another language, gift of tongues. Some people claim it is, but it isn't. It's just it's verbalizing silence, really. It's just going beyond reason and babbling like a child. And it's a good thing to do, being a child. But know it is what it is. I spoke like a child when I was a child. I thought like a child. Again, going back to their knowledge, which they're very keen on. But what do we know? We know so little. So don't be big about yourself for your knowledge. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. So he's calling them to come beyond, to become an adult. And an adult is one who loves. For now, we see in a mirror, dimly. Don't forget what their mirrors were made of. They were made of bronze or brass, and they didn't give us the reflections we've got in a mirror, which can be quite perfect, I guess. They're inverted, left is right and right is left, but apart from that you get a very clear image. They didn't. They looked into a mirror and they got what you'd look into if you looked into a bit of polished brass. So it was a dim reflection that they saw. Then, heaven, we'll see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I'll know fully, even as I have been fully known. Now, faith, hope, and love abide. That now is a different now. It's not now or then. He's saying now, in fact, faith never ends. Hope never ends. Love never ends. But the greatest of these is love.